As I said, Herbert Glendray was the director of the Playhouse, and he became the artistic director. And he was there for a couple of years, I would think 1934 on. And while he was there, my mother prospered tremendously. She did a lot of plays. And he became more and more isolated, though, from the board. The board found his theater too experimental and too avant-garde. I've seen one picture of one of the shows he did, a play by George Kaiser called From Morn to Midnight, which is not well known. It's an expressionist play of the 30s. Anyway, it is way out for 1937. I mean, it just doesn't seem to... Anyway, they fired him. And they brought in a guy named Fred Burley, who became the artistic director of the Playhouse, and the only director, really the true director of the Playhouse through 1964. But when he came in, my mother's roles diminished considerably because he wanted to be more equitable with everybody. And I don't know why he decided. Maybe he felt she'd be too overexposed. And they argued about this for years. One time he wouldn't cast her in a show, and she went to him and pleaded with him, and finally he gave her the role. It was in the Torchbearers, I think the play was, by George Kelly. But it was a kind of a battle, a friendly battle between my mother and Fred Burley over the years. She got many great roles, but she had many more when Glendray was there. It's just an irony of the politics of theater. And I think probably maybe she was satisfied finally that she could only get two or three roles a year, whereas before she would get five or six. That's the difference in the thing. And so her involvement there just continued. Her reviews, I've seen a lot of them, are all positively powerful. And she really etched out a career there that was enhanced also by her writing for the Pittsburgh papers. She wrote a column, I saved the articles, they're beauty tips for women. It's sensational. It's for 1939. I cannot believe it. Because her expertise as an actress, she has charm tips, makeup tips, we're right down to the actual, very specific things you should wear on your face, ladies, and what you should do and how you should walk. And, oh my God, it's unbelievable. There are about five of the articles. And they're exceptionally well written. She knew exactly what she was doing. And became really very, I mean, in the combination of her writing, her theater, and then her radio shows, she did a variety of radio programs, one of which I remember when I was a little boy, called The Safety Lady, WSDAE. It was a 5-minute radio program, which appeared on, I think, every Friday. And when I was in school, I remember this, the teacher would stop the class, turn the radio on so we could listen to The Safety Lady give us a tip. You know, like, don't run across the street and get hit by a truck or something like that. Or whatever it was. And she would invent these little voices. She'd play Billy and Janie, and it was terrific. And I have, to this day, I keep thinking I should call up WTAE and find out if they have any, I'm sure they don't, any tapes of these shows left. Then later, she went into television. I should add that. And she was a part of a very, very successful program called Ask the Girls, which was in the late 40s when the Dumont television station came on. When it was the Dumont Television Network, I'm sorry. Well, it was WDTV before it was KDKA TV. And on WDTV was Ask the Girls. And she was on a panel with four women. And what they would do is they would answer questions from women all over Pittsburgh on how to do this and how to cook that and how to clean this. The panel consisted of Florence Manson, at that time Florence Sanda, who was an actress in Pittsburgh. She still lives in New York, lives in the West Side. Dorothy Randall, who has passed on, and a woman named Catherine Copeland, who I don't know if she's alive or not. Her husband eventually was the famous playwright Richard Nash, who wrote The Rainmaker. And this program lasted a couple of years. Later, she appeared on a television program called your neighbor, I think. A little bit more. In fact, the guy who was the host of that show just died last week. It was Joe Mann and Elaine Beverly. I remember this. And it was a show called Meet Your Neighbor. Anyway, we're really getting into some fine points here. Anyway, her career as an actress was the major thing for her, and a performance of hers guaranteed a pretty good hit. Though I saw her in a couple of turkeys, one of which I didn't like was Once Upon a Mattress. She hated singing, and she had to sing in this show. And she fussed about it. I remember when I was going to school, I remember her putting this record on every day and letting it rock, trying to figure out how to... The music of the show just drove her crazy. And I didn't think it was a very good performance. The woman who played opposite her, Judy Nays, who was an actress in Pittsburgh, lives in California now. When my mother died last year, 1993, I got a letter from her, so I guess, you know, she's still around. But to answer your question again in a roundabout way, my mother had this continued involvement with Pittsburgh theater, radio, and newspaper, and that's how she stayed in the limelight until 72. Unfortunately, after that, she would not act. She would tell me not to tell anybody why, and I would keep it a secret, and later on, of course, it became obvious to people that she may have had some illness, and she developed high blood pressure when she was 60, which is 1972. And her last performance, she said, I'm not doing any more. And she claimed that the doctor told her she shouldn't do any more theater, but I think later on, the fact was that he didn't want her to do major roles, just smaller roles. And she didn't want to do that. But I think she should have kept going. But she did no more theater after that, after her 60th year. It was unfortunate, because there are a lot of roles she could have done. Even smaller ones, you know, where you just sit around and don't do anything. But, I grew up with all that.
A lot of these questions, as much as you're not that old, don't really apply. What more can you tell us about your grandparents?
Well, there's one thing I want to add to what I've said about them. I mean, there are a lot of things I don't know much about, and it might be more difficult. But one of the things I find fascinating, I don't understand it, I have no answers for it, is that to go back a little further back here, in 1852, my great-grandfather, Solomon, decided to move from Germany to the United States so that it was the first time this family came to this country. That is the Rao end of it. I don't know about the Florsheim. I'll tell you in a minute what I think, but he was one of five children. Some of them had died already, and the Raos all lived in southern Bavaria. So he moved to, and ends up in Philadelphia, not New York, the harbor of Philadelphia. I don't know what he did there, but somehow or other, he meets Rosalie Lippman, who became his wife. And the part that I find unbelievable, and I, to this day, I have thought this over a million times, is that both of them left for Iowa and moved to Dubuque, Iowa, where they settled, and where my grandfather was born in 1857 on the Mississippi River and lived there until he was about 6 years of age. It's, to me, I can't figure out why. I know the Jewish immigration occurred and moved all over the country, I mean, in small dribbles and drabbles, but I don't know why they moved to Iowa, because they weren't farmers. Maybe they became farmers out there, I don't know. It's one of the most perplexing problems that I've ever had. Now, what they did was, they moved to Dubuque, settled in where, I guess Solomon and Rosalie had about five children also, four or five children. One of them was Enoch, my grandfather. One was Marcus. One was Abe. And one was Charles. and they all were born, I think, during the Dubuque period. But then they moved to Cincinnati because there was a very large Jewish population in Cincinnati, as I understand it. And from Cincinnati, they then moved to Pittsburgh in 1870. So between 1852 and 1870, my forefathers were on the move, slowly moving east. But if you can tell me why they moved to Iowa, that's a question that of all the possible places, I mean, here they are in Philadelphia, why would they move hundreds of miles west to do this, you know, to live there? And some of my genes are on the Mississippi River. I'm not surprised that I wanted to do a dissertation on Mark Twain. You know. I guess, I don't know. Now, some of this business of what happened to them later, I'm not so sure about. For example, three of the brothers, Abe, Marcus, and Enoch, formed a shirt factory, which was on 2nd Avenue downtown, in the 80s, in the 19th century, about the 1880s, somewhere in there. Now, that may be in material you have, I don't know. And this shirt factory flourished for some time, and then they closed it down. I'm not sure why. Maybe it didn't work or whatever. And Enoch then, somehow or other, between the shirt company and his death, became a city councilman. There was a lot of scandal in the Pittsburgh administration prior to his coming on council, and the reason for this council was to purge Pittsburgh of a bad mayor. And I'm not sure who it was, but this council was formed as an honest council, and I have a newspaper clipping with all the councilmen's homes, so you could see that they lived in nice houses and that they were going to do the right thing for everybody. And apparently they were very good. And when Enoch died, the fire department came out en masse at his funeral, and they flew the flags at half-mast in Pittsburgh. Apparently the fire department in the city thought he was the greatest. And I have an article about that on the day of his funeral, which was, I think he died on Thanksgiving in 1919, something like that. So the involvement of that, of the rows in the Pittsburgh life really begins in the 1880s. Now, the Florsheim Inn, which is my grandmother, my father's mother.
It's Bertha.
Bertha Florsheim, right. I think they come to the United States also around in the 1850s. Her father, Samuel Florsheim, was a violinist. And I don't know much about my grandmother's mother. I've forgotten her name for the moment, it escapes me. But anyway, she lived until she was 82, into the beginning of the century. Bertha's father, Samuel, the violinist, died in 1895. But I don't know what else he did. I have one picture of it.
Do you know where he played the violin or what? Any orchestra?
No, I don't think so. I think he just did it. And he also apparently was a violin maker or something, or he fixed violins or something. I don't know. He seemed to be a fairly prosperous man. I don't know where he got his money, and I don't know how what happened to him. I have pictures of this Florsheim family and all of the subsidiary branches, Guggenheimers and all these German Jews. I have absolutely no idea what happened to any of them. And I have photos of them from about 1870 to 1890, and they're always amazing. I sent all of these to Elizabeth in Toronto, because she's, you know, and she recognized her grandmother. Well, how about that? My grandmother, who was a stickler for details, labeled every picture who the person was. It's unbelievable. You know, I mean, you can't get anything better than that. I mean, most of us just can't get through the day half the time, you know, and she's labeling everything. So I don't really know a lot about my grandparents. I just know that my grandfather seemed to be a very nice fellow. My mother told me that every day of his life, I guess from a certain point on, he wore a carnation in the was withheld. This was his trademark. And I have photos of him, you know, toward the end of his life. He seemed like a nice fellow. And I found in my mother's house his walking cane and his top hat. So I still have that. I don't know what I'm going to do with it, but I still got it.
No,
I'm not going to. My grandmother became very, very involved with all kinds of welfare movements, all the things that were emerging, you know, as problem areas. And her involvement is documented in different ways. It's very difficult for me to remember everything. She served on so many committees and so forth that it's beyond my comprehension.
Well, I recall reading that she was in the, she was director of the welfare board.
Yes.
Of Pittsburgh.
Yes.
Wasn't that rather unusual for a
yes.
woman?
Yes, very much so. I think it's in the 20s that she was
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I mean at that time.
Yes, very much so. Right. The woman who did the dissertation on her couldn't figure out how, with all these activities, she could raise a family. But I think that she did. I don't know how she did it. She had two children, my father and my aunt, whose name was the same as my mother, Helen. And she managed to do it. She was very, you know, aggressive, powerful, but at the same time, very feminine woman. I don't know how she balanced all this out. In the 90s, they would simply have called her a feminist, but on the other hand, they might not have. Because if she acted like a housewife, they might have condemned her. I don't know.
Well, it seemed like she had an unusual number of activities.
Very much, yeah.
Do you remember any of those other activities?
I think it's best if you look at this dissertation. I think it'll help you tremendously. The trouble is, though, and you need to also talk to Diane about the other things she hasn't written about, because she has notes on all of that. That would take you up from... The dissertation takes you up through 1922, I think, and the second part's going to go through 1935. She wants to write a book about it, that's what she told me. Well, you'll talk to me. Yeah, my memories of my grandmother were very, very limited because her illness began in 1945. I was then 5 years old. And she had a chauffeur and a car, and the chauffeur would come over to my house in the car, and I would get out of the house and go into her car, and she would take this little rug and put it over my knees, and we would go around the city. And the chauffeur would drive us all over the place, and then she'd drive me back and leave me off. But there were moments when she was very lucid, and then there were other times when she wasn't. I don't know what happened to her. I'm not sure. I have guessed, based on what I've heard and seen, that she may have had Alzheimer's. But if that's the case, it started at the age of 80. The earliest, because she was still pretty functioning at 75. And later, completely, slow deterioration. Because I remember seeing her when I was about 7 years old. She had lost an enormous amount of weight. And she would not know anybody for a long period of time. And then she would come out of it again. But this woman who was so powerful, and so, you know, to be reduced to that, they said at the time that it was a neurological illness, but I don't know.
His grandmother was Bertha.
Bertha, right.
Okay. What about the other grandmother?
My mother's mother. Okay. I don't have as much information about them. They are the Sissonwanes. And as a matter of fact, when my father married my mother, it was the first time in the recorded history of this family that there was a woman in the family other than German. My mother was Russian. And so I'm half German and half Russian. But it was all German. German all the way down the line. And the Sissonwanes, though that means in German, sweet wine, is a Russian name.
How do you spell it?
S-I-S-E-N W-A-I-N. Her mother was named Leona. And she was a delightful lady. But unfortunately, she died when I was 5 years old. So I know very little about her. My mother's father, Edward Sisson Wayne, died in 1937, even before I was born. So I have no memory of him at all. But recently I found a photograph of my great-grandmother and grandfather. And here's the part for the archives that'll be surprising. The great-grandmother of my mother was not Jewish. My mother's mother was Jewish, but her mother was not. Her name was Carolyn Baer, B-A-E-R. And I have a photograph of her. They came from Ohio. They were born in Sandusky, Ohio. And she married my great-grandfather named Max Sisson Wayne. And I have a picture of him, too. So I have a picture of these people, at least that far back. The Rouse, I got a little bit further back. I got all the way back to Henline, who is my great-great-grandfather and his wife. But on the Sisson Wayne side, we have this Methodist or Lutheran, I'm not sure which puts my Jewishness into doubt sometimes, because the Jewishness comes from the mother. Now, we have to assume that Caroline, since her daughter, Leona, was Jewish, I don't know, so that makes my mother Jewish and that makes me Jewish, but I wonder about that.
Well, couldn't she have converted?
Yeah, she could have. I don't have any idea. I don't, who? You mean my great-grandmother? I don't think she did. But I don't know that. There's a picture of her, a big fat lady, sitting on the steps in Sandusky, Ohio, 1906. It's very strange. Anyway, that's as far as I know about them. I don't know much about them. I think they were merchants in Ohio. And I don't know. There's a lot more documentation on the Riles and the Florsteins because they wanted it that way. I guess they felt they had to be known. They were writing it all down.
Well, it's
but they do. I mean, it is justifiable. It's just that it's an incredible amount of it. I mean, because they also were pack rats, and they saved every little piece of paper that existed. And I've done the same thing, that I've thrown a lot of stuff out. I've just got tons of stuff, and I'm trying to figure out what to do with it, and I think I'm going to have to give it to the Jewish Historical Society of Pittsburgh as part of the working. There's any way to get some of this stuff moved. Like the top hat and the cane, and my grandfather's writing. I have his inkwell when he was city councilman. I also have his wedding ring. I have these little items, you know, that I saved. I have my father's top hat and my grandmother's baby spoon from 1865. Also noted with exactly the date. And who gave it to whom? It's unbelievable. She wrote everything down. So at least that helps.
Could I ask you to go back to when you were very small and living in the family home, which was located where?
On Fair Oaks Street in Squirrel Hill, corner of Fair Oaks and Wilkins.
What was that house like as a young child? Lots of rooms, lots of freedom.
No, I don't think so. The house is still there. It's not a big house. As a little boy, I had a chance to run around and sneak into little drawers and stuff. My upbringing was sort of interesting because my mother kept having maids all over the place. I always had that. So there was always a maid in the house, and we had one who had come to the house when I was 8 months old and stayed until I was 28 when I moved out of that house. And she stayed all the entire time. Her name was Connie Schuler. And I thought she was terrific. In fact, she just died last year also at the age of 85. And she practically raised me along with my mother. So I really had two mothers. But Connie was the general housekeeper. We had a laundress named Maisie. And when my father had his heart attack in 1953, we even hired a chauffeur to drive him around because he had more trouble. The doctor said to take it easy. And in 1953, they had absolutely no idea how to deal with a heart attack. You know, and he died a year later from the illness. So my memory of my childhood isn't the best. It's just that I remember running around the house a lot, causing havoc in the neighborhood. And my father always having to yell and scream to get me back in the house, and my mother yelling and screaming at me to get back in the house. Because I had a lot of friends all over the neighborhood, and we ran rampant through the on Fair Oaks Street and Murdoch Street. That's all we ever did, is run around and behind people's neighborhood property. And, you know, they got upset about that. But the house was not, you know, it's not a huge house, so I could move around, and I had my... I first started living in the den when I was when I was brought home from the hospital, and I lived there for 6 months. But the den is not a good place to live. It's cold in the winter and hot in the summer, so they moved me to another house, another room, which is the one that was my bedroom. And there's nothing much more I can say about it, except that it was a nice, pleasant little house. You know, with a front yard and side yard and a garage and a porch, and we had a fireplace. A small living room, small dining room, a couple of bedrooms on the second floor, and a bedroom on the third floor.
Can you remember any family vacations where the three of you went together?
Yes. Starting in 1944, when I was 4 years of age, my father had met a man named Max Pearl in Pittsburgh, who said to him, "You know, Dick, you ought to go to a little place called Beach Haven, New Jersey." And so, for 1 month, we rented an apartment on 7th Street in Beach Haven and went down there. Then the war continued in 1945, and there was rationing, and my father said, "We can't go, so you have to go to Deer Creek," which was a camp that I went to. A lot of kids in Squirrelville went there. And then beginning in 1946, he came across this professor at CMU named Dave Saylor, who rented a house to him in Beach Haven on 3rd Street. And from 1946 until 1961, we went, my mother, my father, and I, and then just my mother and me after my father's death, to Beach Haven, New Jersey, where we summered about a month a year. And I loved it. It was paradise for me. That is the place that I remember. I've been back as late as 1990, and it's not the same place, of course. It's an island 18 miles at sea. It's off the Jersey Shore. It's about 25, 30 miles north of Atlantic City. And that's where we went. Can I make a telephone call?
Sure.
This may change the taping, though.